Hello, welcome to Waldman's Words with Matt Wallace. Say Wallace Waldman five times fast. I don't know if you can. I sure can't. And Toy Boat, that's another tongue twister to do. Try that four times fast. You can't. Anyway, I'm honestly more excited about this episode than any other episodes I've done for this show. Sorry to everyone else, but this is one of my favorite producers in the history of recorded music. I'm totally fanboying over it, and I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you so much, Matt Wallace, for coming in. He's not in the room yet. This is a pre-recorded intro that will be just a few minutes before the actual interview and be a few minutes before he actually arrives here. But Matt Wallace has done so much, so many records. Ludo is a personal favorite of mine. You know, I'm even stammering. This is fine. And I'm drinking coffee. Stammering over coffee. Ludo is one of the most underrated bands of all time. Maroon 5 Songs About Jane is so damn good. It went diamond and it deserves all its accolades. It's also worked with Faith No More, Ayahuasca. I'm looking forward to learning more about Matt and just hanging with him here at Idobe. The next few weeks, we've got some other behind the scenes people. We've got Christian Wagner over at Good Fight Management. He manages Medina Lake. He manages Mest. I saw Mest so many times. One time with Homegrown, Warp Tours, Mest also. I saw them with MXPX. So it's cool. I want to learn a little bit more about them. And then actually in late April, the following day, I'm going to be coming in for two sessions. One with Nick Holman, who manages State Champs, who's definitely a favorite here at Idobe. And then we've got Jake Posner, who manages the band Arizona. And if you look at their Spotify, they are in the top 500 in the world. And they're also opening for Panic at the Disco. And Panic at the Disco is playing in LA at the Staples Center. So they've definitely come a long way since playing the Troubadour, I'll say that. And yeah, the following week we've got Trenton Warsham, who has a blog and is a really nice boy. So I'm just really excited for everything going on with Waldman's Words. Again, every single Tuesday night, 5 o'clock Pacific time, 8 o'clock Eastern time, the show is on the air. And every Sunday morning, bright and early, 5 o'clock in the morning Pacific time, 8 a.m. Eastern time. You can go on iTunes, download every single episode. You can go on Idobe.com. There's been, I believe, in the 70s right now. So we should probably do something special for the 100th show. But I can tell you right now that this one is super special to me. So stick around for Wallace Waldman, Wallace Waldman, Wallace Waldman, Wallace Waldman. Wow, I almost did it. Thank you. All right, so we experienced a few technical difficulties, but you know what? I have a feeling this is going to get even better because the second take is always the best. So, yes. Matt, thank you for doing Waldman's Words. I know that you went to Berkeley.
Yes.
I'm kind of trying to memorize my pre-speech and
yes.
do it verbatim. I know that you went to Berkeley.
Yes.
But what got you into music? And then you said that's a good question.
That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, to me it's always fascinating to hear how people got into music, you know. And I think a lot of anyway, for me, I learned folk guitar when I was like in sixth grade, I think.
Really?
School. Yeah. My parents kind of said, you should take guitar. So I went there and I used to ride my bike there. And it was like, I was like four or five
without
miles.
A helmet, I guarantee it.
Not only without a helmet, but my guitar in the case, on the handlebars, down one of the busiest streets.
But parents would just let their kids do crazy stuff.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, literally, that was a bad move. Anyway.
And this was Oklahoma?
No. So, born in Oklahoma, my parents were really, really poor. So we lived in a single wide trailer. And then we moved to Denver, lived in another trailer. My parents basically had no money. So we lived in trailers. My dad had a passion for flying, and he wanted to be a pilot, but he started kind of late in life. So all the jobs were overseas. And so we moved to Yokohama, Japan initially.
Whoa!
I went to an all-Japanese kindergarten. I was the only white kid there. And then we moved to Cairo, Egypt, Beirut, Lebanon, Tehran.
So you really stayed put a lot as a young kid.
Yes. Tehran, Iran, and then we moved to Japan, Tokyo, Japan. I lived there for my formative years, from like 7 to 15.
I did not know that. Yes. You do not have an accent.
Yeah, I don't. Isn't that something?
You sound like you're from nowhere.
I think you're right about that, because I did live kind of all over the place. Then, of course, I lived in the Bay Area for a while, but I think my accent's kind of just like bland or non...
Like a newscaster.
Yes, kind of like
it's
that.
Because like they don't want to have like I'm from Long Island. They're not going to have someone on CNN going, so here's who we're going to talk to. They're just not going to do that. So they want, I think, the Midwest quote unquote accent.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say bland if you want. I'm not going to say it.
So anyway, I learned folk guitar, and I found some friends in middle school and high school. We started these bands. We were really influenced by Deep Purple. Black Sabbath, definitely. Also, Emerson, Lake & Palmer.
And you also said Lynyrd Skynyrd's first record. Yeah, that's the one. And now we're back to where we started.
Yes. So, yeah, Lynyrd Skynyrd's first record. So, anyway, and I always had this kind of interesting dichotomy within myself, this kind of push and pull between pop music, because I was really a huge fan of pop radio. I used to listen to my radio at night and just loved all the pop stuff happening. But also, I was into really, like, heavy music with my band buddies. So it was always this thing of just, I like those extremes, and I don't particularly like to live in either one for too long. So if I'm making a pop record that's really melodic, after a while, if I do too many of those records, I'm going to want to really swing wide and get into like heavy or ugly music. So,
well, it's diverse. You're diversifying your own palette. There's only so many times I can listen to pop punk records before I want to listen to something extremely crazy, intricate.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and for me as a career, it probably wasn't the smartest move, because some guys really made their mark once they got stuck in a certain kind of pigeonhole. They can really run with that for quite a while. But the bad news...
But they might not be happy.
Well, no, but the bad news is with that, like, I had friends who just did, you know, like, glam rock or, you know, Cinderella, whatever they were doing, and once that exploded, they couldn't really go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Because my discography is so varied, it was easy for me to kind of just sail those seas without too much damage, and people were
sailing,
like,
oh, the seas of cheese.
Exactly. Primus. I did their first version of Tommy the Cat.
There you go.
Years ago. So I was able to kind of, you know, go with some sense of flux and ebb and flow between all the different extremes.
Well, we'll talk, I guess, what got you into that before, because obviously iAlaska is quite different than Maroon 5. Look at that.
It is.
Pulling it.
It is.
I did my research.
Good.
This is not my first rodeo, but again, I'm going to say that I'm more excited about this episode than anyone I've had.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you for the offer and to having me come down here. So I really appreciate it.
Yay. So I guess you were biking with your folk guitar.
Yes.
But when did you start working behind the boards and realizing that that was, I guess, the best way to use your skill set?
Well, that was always kind of, you know, I was the guy in pretty much every band I was in. I was always the nerdy dude who said,
oh,
hey,
stop it. Don't be so hard on yourself.
No, it's true. No, that's true. And still I'm the nerdy dude. But I was the guy who was like, we're making music. I'm like, hey, if we hook up a couple cassette decks, we can record our music. So I would do the same where we record our stuff on one cassette deck, run it through a little PV mono mixer into another cassette deck, and then sing after we played all the stuff. So I was always kind of that guy. I built like a little cheesy synthesizer, and one of my biggest missteps in my whole career was at the age of 13 years old, I made a wireless guitar out of G.I. Joe walkie-talkies before wireless guitar was really even...
Before Shure did it?
Yes. Oh, way before that. I think Jim Nady did it before Shure did it, but I did this in 1973. I made a wireless guitar, and if I had any money or backing or sense, I would have built that.
Should have gone on Shark Tank, man.
This predated Shark Tank.
What?
By decades.
I thought Shark Tank premiered in 1972. It did not. But I mean, it's pretty once in a while. Sorry. The dad jokes will flow like coffee and wine, but I mean, I did not expect to hear Matt Wallace, inventor.
Because, you know, I was, you know, that was just one of my things, because it was kind of came from that, you know, DIY, do-it-yourself kind of thing where you're like...
Punk rock, man.
Yeah, it was like, you know, we're young, we're inexperienced, nobody's going to let us borrow a studio. There were no studios where we were at. I was living in Japan and on the outskirts of Tokyo. There was nothing. We certainly couldn't afford anything. And so we just had to kind of make our own way, you know, so that's what I did. And that was really the beginning of me... building stuff because I couldn't afford to purchase it, and that really eventually went to my 8-track studio, my parents' garage, where I built spring reverbs, I built phase shifters, I built a couple of plate reverbs, only out of necessity, not because I wanted to do that stuff, and that's what I did. So,
What did you do, I guess, what brought you to Berkeley? Did you go there at, from freshman on? Like, was that what you where you wanted to go to school?
That was kind of where I wanted to go to school, but I lived in the Bay Area, so I ended up going to this place called St. Mary's College, which was like this, whatever, private college. I went there for a couple of years because they had a radio station there, and I got heavily involved in the radio station.
Well, look what you're on right now.
Exactly. Radio
you
station.
Can't see my arms. Yes, the biggest alternative streaming station.
KSMC 89.5, the jewel in the navel of the Rhine Valley. That's what we did. But then during that, I also got into Calix, which was UC Berkeley's radio station. So then eventually, my junior and senior year, went to Berkeley, was student teaching English because I wanted to be a teacher.
My degree's in English, man.
See?
Yeah,
see,
there working. We go. We can communicate.
Yeah, but all that time while I was studying to do that, I had a studio in my parents' garage, and I was making records, and I just was, well, initially demos, then records, and I just, that was my passion, and then I had my money-making passion.
Your practical degree?
Yeah, my practical money-making passion of being an English teacher, which, of course, would make me even poorer than I am at the moment.
It's pretty wild. I mean, teachers now on no salary. I mean, I know that you're quite political on Facebook, and yes. I think we usually agree, but they have to buy supplies with their lack of money for classes, and no one wants to be a teacher now because the pay is so crap. So.
And to take it further, we know teachers personally, and was it 6 or 7 years ago, they took away a $2,000 tax credit for teachers so that when they did buy supplies, they could write off, and now they can't even write it off.
It's a beautiful system we have.
It is.
So I guess what was the impetus to making you really, really go full scale with this, because you're obviously multitasking, and yes. Right now I don't believe you're an English teacher.
Yeah, well, yeah, you're right. You're right. I was student teaching ninth grade while I was a senior at Berkeley, and I really enjoyed it, but things started taking off with bands. Also, see, there's a band that I recorded in my parents' garage that were initially called Sharp Young Men. Then they were called Faith No Man, and then Faith No More. So as I'm building my potential to be an English teacher, I also had some stuff going on with bands. I, you know, around that time working with Primus and certainly with the Faith No Man guys, and things started kind of taking off, and so I ultimately ended up building a studio in Oakland. I took all my stuff out of my parents' garage, did this huge build-out of a studio in Oakland, and just started making records and recording all kinds of
which
people.
Has recently gotten really gentrified, Oakland.
Well, not only has Oakland become gentrified, but my studio was in one of the crappiest neighborhoods, because that's all I could afford, and it's right across from the Fruitvale Art Station, which is where that guy was shot 2 years ago.
Oh, my God.
But even it's gentrified now.
It's now like Williamsburg.
Yeah, it is. So it's really nice that guy still got shot, but back when I lived there, literally there was a 22 or 24 police cars circling this kind of high school for kids who are in trouble, or whatever. And so I was like, ooh. Anyway,
alternative school.
Yeah, alternative school.
Yeah.
So I just kind of I hit that kind of fork in the road, and I was like, well, I'm already kind of doing this, and I wasn't making any money. I lived in this one bedroom apartment. The rent was $330 a month.
Oh my
and
God.
And my friend John moved in, and he slept in the living room, and I slept in the bedroom. So I was paying $165 a month, and even that was kind of tight back then because I was paying myself. I was working for $12 an hour. Including my 8-track studio and me. And so it wasn't money-making, but I was putting money back in the business and building a name for myself.
I moved to L.A. into a one-bedroom apartment with someone. You do what you got to do to build your dream.
Exactly.
So, and it was slightly more expensive in 2003. But so I guess Faith No More, when you were working with them, with both the two other band names that you said, were they completely Genesis stage? Or what was their experience at that time? Were they just playing live locally?
Yes. They're playing live locally, and I basically, once they split off from Faith No Man, they got a new guitar player, new keyboards, all this stuff, and went their way. I actually did their very first sound at a place called the On Broadway, so I used to, I was really in the kind of the crowd with all the young San Francisco bands, and so, I did their demos, I went and did sound at the On Broadway, someone actually gave me a microphone, I ended up interviewing them for one of the radio stations at the college radio station, so I was kind of just in the thick of it with those guys. And
you're in their circle.
I was in their circle, and we kind of just grew up together. While they were becoming a really good band and learning, I was learning to become a producer, engineer, all that stuff. And so we just kind of grew up together in the music field, And it was really lovely. I have to say, the thing that makes me feel the best about my career is that having a platinum record and a number 9 song with a band that I started with my parents' garage, and we did grow together to me is really, it's really great. It's really kind of the perfect way for me to have
had any success. And they just recently, their most recent record was done by you too.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I mixed that. So yeah, I mean, they're great guys, and anyway, I was very fortunate to.
I remember seeing a Mr. Bungle t-shirt in a Faith No More video when I was a young kid. So,
yes.
And I mean, they've been a gateway band for so many people. So I guess, I mean, having a platinum record definitely, I mean, right now, if you have a platinum record, I'm trying to find you. It's very difficult.
Yes.
So
yes.
Back then, so was this like mid to late 80s when it really hit?
I think it hit I did that record in 88 and it was released in 89. And
that's when Epic was like blowing up.
Yeah, and Epic really did blow up for another. It was released in June of '88, and Epic did blow up until towards the end of it. Because honestly, they're on Slash Records with an upstream to Warner Brothers, and they kept saying, "Man, we love your record, but you know, radio's not going to play it. We love your record, but you know, because at that time, rap metal had never ever been heard on
radio. It was hair metal.
There was hair metal, but no rap metal. I know the Chili Peppers were kind of there, but they weren't really a rap metal thing. They were kind of a funk.
They were funky, and they didn't have any like major radio hits.
Yeah,
this is pre Blood Sugar, so
exactly. And so
I was born in 81. This is my shit.
Good. So this was just the kind of thing where the band really built the impetus and what happens ultimately. They had such a groundswell by touring across the States 5 times, going to England a few times, that eventually it became a hit, and then eventually MTV wanted a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the band created all that. They really did it. They were in the van, all of them sleeping under the van or at people's houses. They really made that.
It was definitely not an overnight thing.
Not by a long, long time.
I mean, nothing sustainable is, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So
we had already made 2 records before that. We made one called We Care a Lot. That was an independent record we made in 6 days, including mixing.
Then, how many songs?
Full album. It was like a 10-album.
That's obscene.
Yeah, it is. And we all slept in the same room. It was like 3 times the size of this. The 5 guys and me slept in this little room, walked across the parking lot, and then in 6 days recorded all the songs, overdubbed, and mixed it.
And they're a 5-piece, right?
Yeah, 5-piece.
I mean, sometimes you take more than that for just vocals.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
So
it was like get up in the studio by 10 in the morning and work till midnight and just kind of keep cranking.
Keep cranking.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I guess after that, we're almost done with segment one, but I guess after Faith No More, I mean, you were becoming a more prolific and in-demand producer,
yes.
So who else were you working with?
Oh, I worked with a band called The Replacements around that time.
Yeah, I've heard of them.
And I'm trying to think of all the other, I mean, a lot of other bands. Of course, now my memory is just going out the door.
Well, you have a bigger resume, so it's harder.
I have to go online and see what all else I did.
I have a list in front of me. I just wanted to hear it from the devil's mouth.
Yeah, I just, I'm trying to think what else I did then. I mean, I just did a lot of stuff. I mean, just a ton.
But you've been an active producer for over 30 years now.
Yeah, 35 years of producing.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Since I was 2.
Yeah.
But it's okay. You just said the age of the 3 children you have, and I'm old enough to be their father. So I guess, to me, what really introduced you was when I was in college, I discovered that a band that I had really been a fan of called Kara's Flowers, I guess going from old to new, kind of, that I was obsessed with in high school, one of my favorite bands, a band that just never really took off, that reminded me of, like, kind of a modern, like, edgier, crunchier guitars version of the Beatles. Like, I heard a lot of that, and I heard, you know, Not a Surf and Weezer and stuff like that, and I loved it, and it was, and they were touring with ska bands.
Yeah.
They, like, toured with, like, Real Big Fish and, like, Mustard Plug and, like, random bands, which kind of made no sense, but they broke up, and I think they're only like 2 years older than I am, and just being a kid in high school, seeing like I didn't know anything about Brentwood or LA or that whole scene, and then I heard of a group called Maroon, and then I heard Maroon 5, and I heard Songs About Jane, and when I listened to it, I was like, this, I don't want to like this because it's not Kara's Flowers, but this is a rock band playing R&B. That's what I thought when I was 20, 21 years old, and that record went diamond, and you happened to work on the album Songs About Jane by Maroon 5, so I want to hear as much about that as possible. I'm stammering.
Okay, good. So, continue?
No. I think that my monologue is over.
Okay.
Now
okay,
you.
Okay, so, yeah, you know, it's really interesting. When I got their, there's a number of things that are interesting. One, I got their demos, and I really loved them. I thought they were great.
Were they signed when you heard their demos?
Yeah, they were signed to Octone, which was an indie label that had never put out a record. But there were some of the guys that had been in record companies before, so they kind of knew their way around it. They got some seed money. This guy named James Diener, who I produced a record for him, a band called Flybanger on Columbia. He was the kind of the head of Octone.
I was on Columbia.
Yeah. So he goes, hey, I got this band. They're called Maroon. You want to check them out? And the songs are great, but they went like verse, chorus, and then they would just kind of meander out. They would just kind of wander around. I was like, man, these are good songs. You know, I'm really interested. And so I saw them live, and I saw them at the Whiskey. It was just like a guitar fest. They're just playing solos all over the place. I'm like, I'm not really into this. It's just like solo fest, not my thing. Subsequently, around that time, a band called Days of the New were offering me twice as much money to produce their record. And I was like, man, I really could use the money, but this Maroon stuff is so good. So I basically took a huge pay cut and did the Maroon record. And
well, you were talking about ideas that you had that didn't pay off, so this paid off,
yes.
This one.
This was the biggest long shot I've ever taken in my entire career, because at the time, there was more kind of that kind of new metal stuff. There's a lot of stuff on the radio.
Post-grunge, like all that stuff.
There's all this stuff going on. And when I play some of the stuff to my peer ears, they're like, oh, it just sounds like Jamiroquai, man. It's just a Jamiroquai ripoff. I go, man, I think these songs are classic. I think they're great. And so in pre-production with the band, I said, these songs, you go verse, chorus. You guys need to write bridges. You really need to make these classic songs that will stand the test of time and maybe be covered by other people. And so in that 2.5 weeks of working together, they wrote those bridges, which are stunning and amazing and great. And yeah, while we're making that record, there was another band called Maroon that actually sued them for the name.
Like Blink-182. There was I believe, like a techno group called Blink.
There you go.
The numbered.
So they had the 182. So we were like, you know, they were called Maroon, and they had this back and forth. And you can't use Maroon, so of course they call themselves Maroon 5. There you go. But what's interesting about that record is, along with taking a long shot in working with them, is that the band and I, but specifically them, were really enamored with Lauryn Hill and Outkast and all these other bands, Black Eyed Peas. And so we actually tracked them live in the studio with monitor wedges. I had the most amazing recordings off the floor of this band. They were just absolutely perfect. But they liked all this other stuff, so we went and really took a massive left turn and started making basically a Justin Timberlake record before Justin Timberlake. And it was very, very loop-driven, very urban-sounding. And I really love the fact that they basically took songs that were written on piano and guitar and then supported them with beats, as opposed to just having beats and kind of like trying to make a song on top of it. And we did this whole thing, and I was, you know, we were pushing so hard, and I think we were making a much more creative, interesting, and groundbreaking record. But James Diener, to his credit, said, listen, you got five white guys with guitars, you're not going to go on an urban tour, and you got to bring it back to what this thing was. And he was right. So while mixing, we recut tracks for seven drums, and then did more guitars and stuff like that. And
it came out the way it did.
It came out. And, then
and it was a builder record. It was not a first week's. It's like, I liken it to Weezer's Blue album, which out the gates sold nothing, but it just kept. I remember seeing that they were opening for Michelle Branch.
Yes.
And then I think John Mayer was really helped them, but yes. I mean, yes. Hard to Breathe was the first single. I think it had like five hit singles.
Yes, it was amazing. You're right, it was a builder, and actually, again, to James Diener's credit, Clive Davis wanted...
Small time dude.
Yeah. So there's an upstream to go from, because it was Octones by themselves, they couldn't upstream to Columbia. Or actually, it's BMG, I think it was at the time.
Let's find out.
Yeah. And anyway, so there's an upstream thing.
I thought it was like A&M or something.
No, A&M was later. Anyway, so Clive wanted it sooner, and James said, you need to hold off, you need to wait for us to build this thing even further. And the band, same kind of thing, touring in a van, trying to make it happen. And yes, John Mayer, to his credit, and I ran into him like 5 or 6 years ago, and I said, hey, thanks so much for taking Maroon 5 on tour. And he's like, oh, no, man.
And hyping them, always.
He downplayed it. He was like, no, that was really them. I didn't have anything to do with it. I go, dude, come on. You really did them a solid here. So anyway.
That was when he was like, if Spotify existed, then he'd be like the number one person on it. He was like the top of the top then.
So anyway, so they were doing this touring thing that eventually, after Hard to Breathe kind of set the stage.
J Records.
J Records. So they had this upstream to J Records, and finally Clive Davis got a hold of it, and then he, of course, wrote the $1 million check, and then, boom, promoted This Love. And then at that time, I had friends of mine who were touring the world in different bands in Australia. Oh, I'm hearing the song Hard to Breathe. I mean, sorry, This Love. And then someone else was like, you know, Japan or wherever it is. And so then it became an international hit. It was like, man, that was amazing.
Well, we'll end the Maroon 5 chapter on this note. They won Best New Artist of the Grammys.
Yeah, isn't that great?
That's insane. Yeah. And I remember I was watching it actually on a date.
Yeah.
And they were like, Kanye should have won it. I think because that was when he was there. Yeah. But, like, I was like, no, he shouldn't.
Yeah.
So
it was exciting.
It was really exciting. So thank you for telling that. We're going to take a short break. And then I want to hear about some of your, I guess, your theories and your practices, but I think we should talk about Ludo a bit. That's my thing. That's my band. So enjoy these commercials, enjoy these songs, and we'll be back on Walden's Words with Matt Wallace. Oh, I wish I just had that recording. You just called me funny. Can you say that one more time?
You're funny. You are funny.
Yay! All right, enough about me. This is Walden's Words, this is Wallace. And I tried doing a tongue twister in the intro before we got here. Wallace Waldman, it's hard. It's a tricky one. So Maroon 5, I can honestly talk about Songs About Jane for a lot longer than we did, but I guess a big band that you've worked with for me was Ludo.
Yes.
A very theatrical, quirky band that I saw perform live, and I've never been more engaged by a singer's facial expressions. Ever. You just pointed at me.
Yes.
So I'm not cool enough to have heard Broken Bride before You're Awful, I Love You,
right.
But you did You're Awful, I Love You. So I'd love to hear about that.
Well, first of all, I agree with you about seeing them live. And I think Andrew was an outstanding, stunning lead singer. I think he had...
There was no front man like him.
No one. I mean, he had a persona. He had a look. He was an exceptional writer. Everything about him was perfect. And I saw one of their later shows. They played, I think it was The Whiskey, and it's the only band I've ever seen do this, where they were playing their show, they stopped and they said, okay, everyone sit down on the floor. And you're like, dude, we're all going to sit down on the floor of The Whiskey. Everybody sat down, the band grabbed acoustic guitars and walked around the audience and did their hit while everyone was sitting.
Love Me Dead?
Yes, Love Me Dead. And everyone, and everyone did all that kind of stuff.
Oh.
It was all, but to see everyone completely quiet. I mean, they were completely quiet because there was no amplifier, no stage sound. It was just an acoustic guitar not plugged in. And the
band everyone was silent.
And the room was silent, and they pull up. I go, there's not a band I know that could tell the audience to sit down, be quiet, and now we're going to walk around and sing the song for you. I mean, seriously, they blew me away seeing them play live. I think they...
Was that before you worked with them, or was that after it already was established?
Yeah, it was established, yeah.
So I want to hear about this, because you could definitely talk about this with the band. So when you work with a band, like, talk to me about the pre-production process to handing in the masters. Like, I want to hear about how it worked with them.
Right. Well, with them, and like with most bands, there's usually about a two-week period where we spend 10-plus hours a day in a rehearsal room. And for me, I always start with the first maybe 30% of the day we're on acoustic guitars and we play the song.
Campfire.
My feeling is that if we can make the song work on acoustic, then we have a song we can build in the studio.
I agree.
And sometimes you have a song that's just like the same chords over and over again, then it's like, okay, how are we going to make this build? You can do it even with three chords if you maybe invert the chords up so you feel like, oh, we're in the chorus. So for me, I kind of bring everything down with our microscope and we play it. And the nice thing about playing acoustically without all that noise is that you can actually talk about what you're playing. Like, okay, let's go to the G here. No, okay, now to the D. You know, and you can kind of coach each other.
You can have a dialogue.
You can have a dialogue. And because it's very conversant, it's also really relaxed. And so to me, when you get the song organized and really foundationally ready, then when you put on the big, loud instruments, it can sound great.
You can only spice a turd so much.
Exactly. Well, one of the things, I made a mistake for about 10 years. I made records, I think, that were not my best, and that is because in rehearsal, we always rehearse with the band playing live and loud. Now, anytime you hear like a thundering drum pattern or a big guitar chords and stuff, you can be convinced that you have a song. Oh my God, it's so powerful, so powerful. It's like, well, it's not really a good song. And to me, I want great songs, and then once you get all that loudness on top of it, it'll be even better. And to me, it's really essential to have well-crafted songs. Not every song needs a bridge, but man, sometimes the bridge is the right thing to do to make it really step up and out. I want the listener to hear up to chorus two going, oh my God, what a great song. How can it get any better? And then it actually lifts even further. You're like, no way, no way. And to me, that's really essential to making great, timeless music.
Did you hear any of the stuff before you do the pre-production? Like, how did it work with that? Or was it the first time and then they... Because I know Andrew is the primary writer. Yeah. I think Tim wrote a few songs.
Yeah.
But did you hear them before? Did he bring like 20 songs and you're just like, yes, no, change? Like, how does that work?
Well, before I work with any band, they usually send me a number of songs. Generally, anywhere between 18 and, say, 28 songs. And so there's a big...
Like front to back, fleshed out?
Well, ideally, that's what they are. If bands aren't that prolific, then yes, I'll have some things that are just like little snippets. You know, like Back to the Moon 5, it was just like verse, chorus, you know. That's to me, it's not fully fleshed out, but there's some killer choruses.
We said we legally can't discuss them the second half.
Okay, sorry.
I'm just kidding.
Okay. So anyway, but yeah, so any before I even work with a band or we ever meet, I always get the demos first. I listen to the demos. If I like what's there and I feel like I can bring to the table, then I will contact them, and then maybe we'll have a phone conversation. We'll talk, hey, and for me, I think I'm in the minority in this with producers, and that is I spend a lot of time with songs and demos before I talk to anybody, because I sit down and I make pretty extensive notes, and I have all my notes from all the
producers. Give me an example of a note.
The key of the song is wrong. The singer's at the peak of his range in the chorus, and it would sound better if we came down a half step or a whole step, because it would make his or her voice sound fuller.
For those not understanding half step and whole step, the letter G, a half step down is an F sharp.
Yes.
A whole step down. I'm just trying to teach. I want to learn these people.
Yeah. Well, just like if you hear a singer who's pushing at the top of their range.
Straining.
If they're straining, for some songs that can be great.
Well, Kurt Cobain.
Kurt Cobain can do that, yes.
Yeah.
But other songs, after a while, it just is not powerful enough. So if you can just bring it down a half step even, the singer can actually approach that part of the song with confidence. And I tell them, if we can get it where you can even kind of swoop up a little bit and down onto it, that'd be really great. So we do that. We talk about arrangement. Guys, you're going verse, chorus, solo, and then outro. And I go, well, we got to, you know, this is a really good song. This chorus is really good. Can we take this chorus and put it in after verse one or two? And to me, it's just like taking these blocks and just moving them around.
And shuffling. So
then we shuffle everything around. We talk about the tempo. We talk about the groove. We talk about the melody. Lyrics. I talk about lyrics.
And you would give these notes even before you even talk to them or meet them, like really, really well thought out, extensive notes?
Oh, man. My notes are absolutely extensive. I'll mention lyrics that I think are great or lyrics I think are sketchy. I'll talk about, you know, performance parts like drums or guitar chords or whatever it is.
Because you only have a short amount of time to... Like a typical pop song is like 3 minutes, 17 seconds or something, so there should be no filler, right?
Exactly. And so for me, the reason I do is, one, I want to be prepared. I want to walk in. I know there are producers who are kind of just do the thing like, yeah, love your vibe, we'll make it. And they can kind of BS their way through it. I don't have that kind of confidence, and I want to be prepared. I want to know what we're going into. And for me, it's important to say very specific things to any band or artist I'm working with so they can decide if I'm even the right guy. Because if you go, oh yeah, I always get a vibe, it's like that doesn't mean anything.
Right.
But if I go, I want to change the arrangement here, I think this key right here is not quite right, I think this lyric needs to be changed, they're going to go, nah, he's not the right guy.
Like Bob Rock wouldn't work for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, it's
Bob
like,
Rock,
I mean.
Yeah, he's that kind of guy. He gets in there and.
John Feldman, like these people.
Yes. So for me, it's important, as long as before I take a flight out to meet them or they fly out to work with me, it's like we talk about this stuff specifically. And they can give me their feedback, whatever they think, and they can mull it over. And if I'm the right guy, give me a holler. Then we meet up, and by then we've had a couple phone conversations, and we've usually done things like, okay, we're going to focus on 15 songs, and we're going to make sure we got 10 ready for the record, and we've got 3 outliers that if we have a little spare time, we'll kind of work on those because we have a feeling about them, but they're not really ready. And so we'll do that. We'll kind of keep chopping away at these things, getting them molded into shape. And then it's like, oh, what about that one song, the song number 17? It's like, well, let's try it out. And sometimes those outliers can turn into real contenders. Like they're the dark horse that can make it back in. And then sometimes you have a song that you really believe in, you think is going to be great, and then it can fall by the wayside.
It doesn't even go on the record.
Yeah, exactly. And so to me, I want to be prepared discussing with them before I get out there and before they come out, before we start working together. And then, okay, great. Now the hardest work on a record is absolutely pre-production. At the end of the day, I am most thoroughly just worn out more than any day in work in the studio because...
Well, you're doing more constructing than recording.
Yes. Yeah, recording then you're just... Because once you've kind of sketched out in the studio, then you just kind of flesh it out. But here you're really like, you know, why doesn't this course work? Can we move this thing around? What, you know, why isn't this happening? Or what, you know, what's the deal with this section right here? What do we do? And so it's like, okay, ride another bridge. Let's try another bridge, you know. So then you stick in a new bridge. Okay, that's better, you know. So anyway, it's really, for me, to me, records are made or broken in pre-production.
I've never heard anyone say that. I manage producers, and I've spoken with many actually on the show, and everyone attacks it differently. And some people, like, for example, when recording vocals, some people do full takes. Like, you do, like, 15 of those, and then they comp, and they're sure. Like, they're good. And some people are like, no, you're doing line by line, word by word, until...
Right.
And people don't normally focus on pre-production as honestly as much as I think they should.
Yeah. Well, because
when you're recording, like... Yeah. You're not as amenable.
Yeah, exactly. And also budgets, you know, aren't that huge, and you can't spend time in the studio kind of fishing around for ideas. You have to at least have a map. You can vary from the map, but you at least need a map of where you think you're going to go. And then if you kind of go off, that's fine. But if you're going in the studio and you're building the map of where you think you're going to go, you better have $250,000. Otherwise, I mean,
you should have an outline when you write a book.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I've done records really, really inexpensively. The Faith No More's Real Thing and Maroon 5's Songs About Jane were both under 70 grand budgets originally, which is really low by, major label standards. Most people are 150 grand, 225 grand is what you would usually
And in
use.
2018, it's...
Oh, it's even lower
it's,
now.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that figure yeah, is yeah, astronomical.
Yeah. Yeah, and now it is, but back then it was like, that was a lot to pay for studios, mm-hmm. engineers, programmers,
everything. Runners.
Yeah, everything. I mean, you had to... Yeah, so anyway.
So I guess was when you were doing your Awful I Love You, and then I'm going to bring up the band that made your eyes really light up because you didn't expect to hear them, Ayahuasca.
Yes.
But was there anything during the pre-production that was just changed completely, 180'd, and then ended up being released?
That's a good question. There probably was, but I can't even remember at this point in time. That's a really good question. I mean, sometimes there are songs.
That was one with Go Getter Greg, Lake Pontchartrain,
yes,
Please,
yeah.
Love Me Dead. I'm not looking at a list, audience.
Yes, that's amazing. Those are all, I mean, to me, those songs were just so stunning. They for the most part, were pretty together. I'm trying to think which ones we've kind of really chopped around. But, I mean, I've had other bands that I've had to take things and really scooch them around. But that one, I think, was...
It was more concise than Broken Bride. I love it, but those songs are all extremely long. And
yes.
You're Awful, I Love You, it's not that way.
Yeah, You're Awful, I Love You, for me... Okay, here's the thing. For You're Awful, I Love You, I really wanted the chance of honing their songs to a point that we could actually get some of them on the radio. And, you know, there's a couple of songs that had...
When radio mattered.
Yes, it did. And there are a couple of songs that had, like, odd time signatures, and I just said, listen, we can't do odd time signatures. You know, you can't go into, like, this weird... thing in the course, it's got to stay 4/4 just because that's where pop is at this point.
It's time. Driving.
Yes. And so for me, that was really the thrust was, listen, we did have some things on, I think Pontchartrain kind of meandered, but the ones that I wanted to be focused, we really kind of nailed down. And to me, that's one of the biggest decisions as a producer. It's like, okay, some songs you need to buckle down and kind of, you know, put them into a shape that's going to work, and other songs you need to either allow them to kind of meander, or you have to encourage them to kind of go. Sometimes a band will have a song that's getting sort of meander, but they don't, and it's kind of right standing right between like tight pop and more meandering kind of experimental, and sometimes you gotta go, that song, you should let it run. Go longer with it and really explore and have some fun with it.
Well, a lot of the songs in the 90s could never be on the radio now, like they have 2-minute long intros.
Yes.
Like the song Come Down by Bush, for example.
Yes.
That would not be able to be a hit now. It's a constant meander building.
Yes.
And now it's like, shut the hell up, get to the point.
Yeah.
So
the build doesn't work. And also people's attention
Wait, what?
people's attention spans by virtue of, you know, video games, Facebook, Instagram, all
the way stuff. Television shows are edited now.
Yes. Everything is really very rapid. And even videos are really rapid now, like music videos. In the old days, they used to have longer, like old movies and old videos had longer flowing shots where you didn't have these like abrupt cuts. And because of that, I think that pop radio, you've got to kind of get to the chorus really quickly. The intro has got to be quick.
Well, my wife and I are in our 30s, and we were revisiting Real World, and we watched the most recent season, and the way that it was edited was so freaking frenetic.
like just the way that they did like shot to shot, shot to shot. It's all over the place. Like I was exhausted watching a TV show.
Yes.
And it's a reality show. It was just so yes. Everything is different. So I guess we're going to close this out in about 5 or 6 or 7 or 23. But right. Ayahuasca.
Yes.
I would say that like, I mean, Ludo is my favorite band, but they're not as underrated as Ayahuasca because yes. No one knows who Ayahuasca is. So talk to me about that.
And Ayahuasca, to me, was one of the most stunning,
vocal,
exciting bands. Well, the whole thing, because here's the thing. Brandon, I met with them a couple times. And they were on, what was the name?
They were on Fearless.
They were on Fearless. And Fearless, I think, signed them because they saw that they were really good. But I don't know if Fearless knew what to do exactly with them.
Well, it was a little bit out of, like, at the time, yes. Fearless was like screamo and like pop
yes.
punk.
Yes. But Brandon had this thing where he, at home, would take GarageBand and would build these beautiful, giant sonic soundscapes. And literally, he would come to the studio, and I'm not exaggerating, he would have songs that had 100 to 120 tracks.
Wow.
Of violins and sounds. And
so epic.
Really epic. Really, really epic. But these things were just grand. And so he had this whole... I mean, here's the thing. That was the one of the most difficult records to make because... He had this sonic soundscape that was already dense and full. And then we had to superimpose a five-piece band on top of that and make it work and make it so you could still kind of hear things. Very, very, very difficult. But what he was doing was so...
He was ahead of his time.
He was so ahead of his time, and his ear for melody is ridiculous, and I'm a huge fan of what he does. And I tried working with him, with Brandon and Cameron, subsequent to that, once the band disbanded, I worked with them and helped him kind of shape some of the stuff in a little more pop thing, and now he's kind of rebranded himself as Roy English, and now he's making this other music. He toured with 5 Seconds of Summer.
Wow.
And he's got these pictures of him in front of these like huge audiences, and so he's, you know, he's really, really talented, and I think he's going to do something, but he's, but it's interesting because when I worked with him during the Ayahuasca, he was very, very, very like super nerd, you know, had like this real, like little funny backpack and these big glasses and I told him, kind of that was that kind of thing, but now he's, you know, he's a very handsome guy and he's got this look and his cheekbones are
more chiseled.
He's really chiseled and, you know, he's got that look and he's also really talented, so he's gonna probably do something, I think. You know?
Well, in my eyes, he already has.
Yeah.
So
I mean, I'm so glad you brought that record up because that to me was one of the very, very few records that didn't make it that I really believe should have. And when those guys were on tour, they came through and they played at the Troubadour, and I saw them play.
My favorite venue you've mentioned
yeah,
so far.
Yeah. And so I went back and I go, "Oh, come here!" And Brandon's like, "Hey, come back to my van. I got some music." So I went back to the van. In the back of the van was like this big foam mattress, and Brandon had his computer there with headphones and a microphone. He was writing, singing, and recording all the stuff that we ultimately ended up using on the record. He was already programming while they were driving between gigs,
and not on a bus. It's a lot harder to do in a van.
It's in a van. They hooked up this converter to the darn engine so they could all go run their computers. And Brandon was literally compiling 100-track sonic soundscapes that were panoramic and cinematic and just gorgeous on this little computer on GarageBand. And that was the foundation for that record. And he had a vision, and he had melody and lyrics. And
An incredible singer.
Incredible singer. And that record is just the one that I thought, oh, man.
Yeah, no, really? That record did not pop.
It didn't, and it was so
It was
good.
Strong.
I mean, it was probably just too, honestly, probably too dense for most listeners because it has so much going on there. Man, I thought it was groundbreaking. I wish it could have been even a record that got out there enough that influenced other people. You know, people go, yeah, man, Ayahuasca. I wanted to see the ripples after that pebble of Ayahuasca was dropped into the pond. I wanted to see the ripples of the
They're not a band that is even talked about. Like, there's bands like Acceptance.
Right.
That they released a record called Phantoms in the early 2000s that was monumental for bands in the emo scene,
right.
But it just didn't do well and got them dropped. And
right.
Weezer's Pinkerton is
right.
like the ultimate record that no one gave a shit about until recently.
Right. Yeah.
So it's just the way it is. Well,
yeah.
We're going to have some parting thoughts with Mr. Wallace, not Wallace Waldman, Matt Wallace. If you could give some young kid who's listening to the show in Birmingham, Alabama.
Yes.
I mean, you can get into politics if you want to. But some advice who wants to become a record producer.
Right.
What would be the number one thing you would say?
What you record is more important than how you record. So it doesn't matter if you...
Well, that's not an ego way to do it, because there's a lot of people who...
No, it's not about the technology. And I know I have arguments with certain other producers and engineers about this, but I really believe that it's 80% of it is going to be the band, and the artist is going to really create the thing that we hear. And us as a producers are helping them get that last 20%. And so it's not about the proper mic or the proper mic preamp or whatever all that stuff is. Here's what we're doing. We are basically...
Conduits?
We are basically trying to help the band convey emotion. If we could just plug into each other's brains, we wouldn't have to sculpt or dance or write poetry or sing songs. But because we can't do that, we have to sing songs. And all we're trying to do is help the artist present what it is they're trying to convey to the listener. And that's the through line and the thread between the singer, who's the narrator of the song, to the listener. And so just try not to get stuck in, like, I need this kind of gear. You don't need that kind of gear. You just need to find an artist or band who's got a point of view with some really good songs and get stunning performances. And that's really what it's all about.
Well, this was a stunning performance for me. So I guess if you want to say quickly how people can check out what you're doing, and also, is Hoobastank the most recent project?
Yeah, Hoobastank's the most recent project. They're awesome. They're a great band, and their record's going to be coming out in about a month. It's called Push Pull. They're fantastic. I want to say thanks to Scott so much for inviting me. We talked about this like 9 months ago or something.
Yeah, as we had a baby, and then we booked it.
Exactly. And so it was one of those things. This is the first and only interview I've ever had that had that kind of lead time. Because when we booked, I'm like, really? You're like, yeah, that's kind of what I'm available. Like, okay, well, that's... And so I figured we'd kind of sort of forget.
It's like we were scheduling an album.
Exactly. And so I really appreciate the opportunity to be a part of this. So I want to thank you very much.
Well, I'm going to end on that note by thanking myself. So thank you, Scott Waldman, for doing this interview. No, seriously, Matt, I'm so stoked you're here. And I'm happy that the people listening even know who iAlaska is now. Yes, if they could just check out their catalog. So,
and also I'm on Facebook, Matt Wallace on Facebook. If anyone wants to write to me or whatever they want to, just hit me up there and I'm happy to chat.
That's awesome. I mean, I see your feed, so that is 100% true. Every single Tuesday night, 5 o'clock Pacific time, the time zone we're in, 8 o'clock Eastern time, Waldman's Words airs. In addition, every single Sunday morning, bright and early, 5 a.m. when Matt is recording Hoobastank vocals,
yes.
Or 8 o'clock on the East Coast. You can go on adobe.com, stream every episode, and you can go on iTunes and download every single one. Matt, you rock.
Thank you.